I have everybody's attention. I congratulate you for your staying power late on a Friday afternoon. Well done. We're very grateful to Charles Tannock for likewise coming on a Friday late on a Friday afternoon to talk to us about the parliamentary dimension. We've spoken most of the time about the member states and the council and the high representative in the External Action Service, and the parliament's hardly got a look in. So I think having a whole session on the parliament is no bad thing, it's a very good thing. Charles, may I call you Charles?
Absolutely.
Charles has been a member of the European Parliament since 1999. He is actually a distinguished psychiatrist, consultant was, and maybe still is, consultant psychiatrist, and was a senior lecturer at University College Hospital. In the European Parliament, he seems to have been involved in every single country group that exists. Looking him up on his website, and he's spoken also on every single international issue that exists. I just looked at some of them, EU, Israel, Philippines, the Middle East, all written articles. Syria, Burma, Ethiopia, Putin, Congo, Kosovo, Montenegro, Kazakhstan, Belarus, Bangladesh, energy, the list goes on. So you get an idea that this is a man of eclectic views and vision, and we look forward to hearing from him. On European affairs, he's Foreign Affairs and Human Rights Spokesman in the UK Conservative Delegation. He's a full member of the Foreign Affairs Committee and a full member of the Human Rights Committee. So I have in front of me the text of Article 36 of the Treaty on European Union, which says what the role of the Parliament is in reference to the High Representative and therefore the EEAS. It's basically an obligation to consult the Parliament and take account of its views. And also it gives the Parliament rights to question special representatives. The Parliament also, I know, sees outgoing EU heads of delegation, has the right to cross-question them, although not, unlike the US Senate Foreign Relations Committee, doesn't have the right to block them. And it also has an obligation to hold a debate on progress on implementing the CFS twice a year. So, Charles, over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Brian, and thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to what a sort of jobbing practitioner MEP does in the foreign affairs areas. Just to make the, just for the record to make it clear, I'm a Conservative that actually supports British membership of the European Union, which is an increasingly challenging case to make in my political party. But certainly after 13 years in office, this is my third term, I believe the EU, in spite of all its faults and needs for reform and flexibility, to generally be a force for political and economic good in the world helpful to British national interests. It's clear that we now live in a time of unparalleled and long-lasting peace, but certainly today's globalized world is characterized by emerging economic giants like Brazil, Russia, India, and China. So generally, I think smaller countries, and although Britain is still a large economy globally, fifth or sixth, depending how you measure it, obviously, in relative terms, we will probably shrink over the coming decades. So forming lasting alliances with each other within the European Union 27 is bound to give us more foreign policy influence united than if we were to go alone or we were divided. And certainly a European Union of 500 million people and 27 member states, which consists of the largest economic bloc in the world, is a force to be reckoned with, both in economic and trade terms, but also in foreign policy terms. And so Europeans, mindful of the BRICS phenomenon, will become progressively and determinedly more the Europeans have to realize that the world's going to become a more multipolar event, rather like in the earlier part of the 20th century, after the collapse of the British Empire and British primacy, the world started to change with the Soviet Union. So what will matter in this world for the UK, and I'm speaking mainly as a British politician here, is the ability to exercise power and influence in both our bilateral, national, but also our collective multilateral foreign policy objectives. Therefore, I see my role as a British MEP as one of applying a degree of democratic supervision and scrutiny over the relevant CFSP and CSDP institutions to achieve this aim, and also to support the UK and the European Union in the coming global battles, particularly in terms of promoting better human rights and democracy, but most importantly, to preserve global peace and prosperity for all of us. Again, as a Conservative MEP, you might expect me to start off by being immediately hostile to the common foreign security policy. You could also be forgiven for thinking that Europeans do not like to talk about exercising foreign policy power. For most Europeans, power is understandably associated with struggle, conflict, and war. However, we must come to understand, both British citizens and our European EU citizens across the other 26, that the world is sadly not yet conclusively heading towards a liberal democratic consensus based on the individual or citizenship, but that it will remain for the foreseeable future at least a decidedly political place and a competitive one, and sometimes, sadly, a dangerously challenging place. So I think you have to be very much engaged in this kind of realpolitik as an MEP involved with foreign policy. So although the media in this country and the politicians, you know, over the road in the House of Commons quibble, the European External Action Service has a huge potential, in my mind, to develop a role in charting a realistic and effective course in global geostrategy and asking how we as Europeans might better exercise collective power over subject areas that are of particular importance to us and our allies of the free democratic world. In particular, I'm thinking of the Commonwealth and the United States. Of course, this includes thinking much harder about how we can resist and combat foreign powers' own political geostrategic advantages and advances, which, as they become more resourceful, these powers, and they continue to grow in relative terms, they adopt more assertive foreign policies that are incompatible with our own. And we are seeing this increasingly with countries like China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, just to name a few. Against this challenging backdrop, three crucial factors come to mind, and how the EU could become a foreign policy actor in this new world order scene. First, can the European External Action Service, with the Commission alongside it, flex its muscles in the multitude of multilateral organizations and international agreements that deal with matters of EU competence? Secondly, how will the structure of European diplomacy evolve? Will it become what I would call a new concert of Europe with institutional and popular support, or will it become a kind of Hobbesian battle continuing under the blue and gold flag? Thirdly, is there going to be any real democratic accountability in the pursuit of foreign policy aims agreed behind closed doors? So over to what I do in the European Parliament. I've been giving you that kind of overall sketch of where I see things panning out in the coming years. The primacy that member state governments, through the Council, and it's been pointed out under Article 36, rightly have on foreign policy does not mean that the European Parliament has no influence whatsoever in this sector, both on the CFSP and also, funnily enough, over national bilateral policies. In fact, MEPs have considerable influence, given the fact that they cover not only all 27 member states in their provenance and all conceivable shades of political opinion, but they have strong links to their own national parties and governments or opposition parties, as well as being able to, at EU level, engage with the union bodies and players. In fact, an MEP, as opposed to, say, a European External Action Service diplomat, straddles the national and EU level by physically being in both places every week as we commute between our home countries, and I'm here in London, my constituency today, and I'll be back in Brussels on Monday. So the fact that we go backwards and forwards and meet politicians both here and there would actually make us a little different from the kind of Brussels bureaucracy who are mainly stationed there all the time. In addition, the Foreign Affairs Committee that I sit on is packed with influential former foreign ministers and even prime ministers from many of the EU member states. I have to say that hasn't happened yet for a British one. I can't imagine a former British foreign secretary or prime minister going to the European Parliament, but it may happen in the future. On scrutiny and oversight, I must pay a special tribute on this occasion to Cathy Ashton, the High Representative. She granted to us MEPs, when setting up the service, new de facto powers above and beyond the 36 of scrutiny and oversight. For instance, she guaranteed for the first time, although it was there in writing, it's actually now happening in reality, regular appearances before the Parliament in person or sending the rotating presidency in office, i.e. in this case the Cyprus Foreign Minister, who was before the Foreign Affairs Committee this week in Strasbourg, in a way which has never happened before or as frequently. In reality, she had little choice at the time, because ultimately the European Union Parliament legally controls the External Action Service budget, as she discovered, and legislates on the staff regulations. So without those two things, it wouldn't have been possible to set up the service in the first place. Last week, for the very first time, Cathy Ashton took five MEPs with her on her task force visit to Egypt. And that, in my view, is evidence as to how seriously she considers having the support of the European Parliament. This enhanced role, which we now enjoy, has somewhat, in my view, politicized foreign policy debate in the European Parliament beyond where it was before. And somewhat ironically, her initially strong supporters from the EPP and the Liberal group, the ALDE group, who wanted a more federal approach have grown more critical of her lack of using her powers of CFSP initiative, just as the more Euro-realist MPs such as myself have grown more favourably disposed towards her lower-key, more cautious approach, which does not constantly demand proactively more Europe as the only solution to every problem, and instead prefers her chosen path as a messenger for the CFSP common position of the 27. Many, such as Elmar Brok, who is the chairman of my committee, or the Green Group, led by Franziska Brankner, for instance, want Ashton and the External Action Service to do more. But as a Conservative, we see the European External Action Service as supplementing UK national diplomacy and must not seek to replace our bilateral relations. Neither do I see, from a UK point of view, the need for a consular role for the External Action Service, but smaller countries may wish to develop this aspect further. To my relief, the British Foreign Office has said in my presence that, on balance, the UK has been able to amplify its foreign policy objectives through the External Action Service. However, what we don't yet see is the evidence of any cost savings through the economy of scale or the ability of bilateral embassies to be reduced in size and some of the workload taken up by the EU delegations in third countries. The EAS is also well aware of the fact that it must make this case for more funds to be made financially available, and it must also be subjected to audit if these aspects of its working life are able to be demonstrated as bringing value added and cost savings to the national exchequers. Given the combination, as I said, of influence and scrutiny, I am personally constantly being lobbied by ministers, ambassadors, think tank experts, pressure group campaigners, all arguing for their respective countries and causes. I even get requests to meet the Foreign Office ministers when they are in Brussels. I periodically meet the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House of Commons and the chairman of the Conservative Human Rights Commission to coordinate our responses to human rights areas where I'm the coordinator for the ECR. These entities all know that the European Parliament, through its parliamentary resolutions, its committee work, its parliamentary delegations, and other mechanisms such as debates and parliamentary questions, and now for the first time we can actually put a parliamentary question directly to the High Representative, have significant influence and a voice. And this is not only the case in direct matters of foreign policy, but also in the closely intertwined areas of aid and trade policy, where after the Lisbon Treaty, MEPs have legislative powers for the first time. We also have a role on human rights, security and defence matters, the CSDP, and in particular civilian CSDP missions, where the budget, again, is directly controlled by the European Parliament. The administrative budget of military CSDP missions, again, is controlled by the European Parliament. So we have that kind of nuclear button, if we really wish to push it, to try and get our way if we feel very strongly about something. One new function, which was alluded to by Brian, is that of the Parliament's Committee on Foreign Affairs conducting hearings examining EU heads of delegation and EU special representatives prior to taking out their key postings in third countries. This is something akin to a US Senate confirmation hearing, but so far the candidates have all been so excellent that none of us have actually given the thumbs down to any of them. So we haven't yet tested our powers, whether if we actually said they were really not up to the job, whether they would be withdrawn and somebody else would be sent to take their place. So I don't know how powerful we are, but so far they've all been brilliant, mainly candidates as senior ambassadors from their national foreign ministries, former foreign ministers, etc. And they represent the elite of the Member State Diplomatic Corps and ex-commission relex officials. So this is encouraging for the future effectiveness of the EAS in its role as a messenger for the CFSP. However, there are some weaknesses, and I'll now wind up by talking about those. The EAS needs to be more visible in producing and delivering a strategic foreign policy in these turbulent times that we live in. I've been outspoken occasionally about mistakes, for instance, the decision to abolish the post of the EUSR for the South Caucasus, which I think was important in the frozen conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh, which may well explode at any time. In the Libya conflict, the EAS dragged its feet and clearly failed to provide foreign policy analysis and coordination that it insisted it could have done. There's been considerable increase in demand now recently by Cathy for the budget to be expanded for the EAS, and this somewhat reneges on her initial commitments to organize budget neutrality. So these demands, in my view, are unacceptable given the austerity measures necessarily imposed now upon national foreign services and foreign ministries. So in the current economic climate, unless savings can be demonstrated by the European External Action Service, really budget neutrality has to be the norm. The EAS, sadly, in my experience, still has turf wars with the Commission over trade and development issues in third country delegations and reflects the kind of relax historical priorities, such as having, I give an example, a large EU delegation in Barbados, but none in the regional hub of Panama. The Commission was able to hang on to too many staff, some of whom work in areas more properly within the competence of the External Action Service. So in conclusion, Europe must understand the reality of global power and decide policy accordingly to the world as it is and will become in future. The European External Action Service is the developing body tasked in monitoring all of this, but it must be focused and realistic in its objectives and provide cost effectiveness and value added. National parliaments, particularly over CSDP matters, and the European Parliament over both CSDP and CFSP, should cooperate more and jointly take more interest in the workings of the EAS. And I have to say all the time, we're desperately keen to get more MPs to come over and sit in with us and look at these matters together, but there's a lot of resistance, certainly from the Westminster House of Commons. So, and this would involve requesting regular updates on skill shortages, lines of authority, budget problems, etc. And there's often a shortage of Brits applying for key jobs in the External Action Service. In the end, the European External Action Service's success or failure will largely depend on whether member states and Europe's institutions take its transparency seriously and engage fully and choose to make their criticisms constructive for the future. So thank you very much for that kind of tour of what I do as an MEP involved with foreign policy in the European Parliament.
Thank you, Charles. I thought that was a very interesting survey. Also, your own views as a Conservative MEP on the relations between the EAS, Cathy Ashton, CFSP and CSDP, and the European Parliament. You sounded, on the whole, pretty content with it. So my first question would be, are you actually content with it? It seems to me, actually, that the European Parliament is getting more powers over CFSP than national parliaments, and certainly our own, over national foreign policy. I mean, I don't think that William Hague would take five MPs on a mission. That's more like the American model. So there is this sort of creeping extension of what the European Parliament, expects Cathy Ashton and the EAS to do for them. Are you in favor of that, given that more power in this field for the European Parliament could be seen to be in conflict with the, at least in the British view, strictly intergovernmental nature of the CFSP with responsibility, accountability, real accountability to national parliaments rather than the European Parliament?
Well, I'll start off by saying that, although I don't want to wish to name the individuals concerned, but let me just say that very, very senior members of the Foreign Office at the highest level have confirmed to me that after a year or more of the service being up and running, in spite of all its faults, on balance, it seems to be able to, generally speaking, project and amplify British foreign policy objectives. So it isn't running counter to our national interest. If we want to, we can always exercise the veto, but the veto is a rarity in foreign policy amongst the 27. So I generally take the view that if something has come out as a CFSP, then it is the policy of the British government as well, and therefore anything that I do to make sure that that is properly implemented, that the players are being held to account, and that there is some scrutiny and oversight in the way things are being conducted has to be a good thing. The fact that the House of Commons, sadly, doesn't have any such hearings with people such as yourself as ambassadors, although I did have from David Lidington now that they are slightly behind the curve but trying to catch up, that there is now an instruction from the Europe Minister that when ambassadors are coming back to London that they should pop in and see the all-party political group or make themselves known to the parliamentarians interested in that country. So there is something also brewing in the House of Commons in that direction. But you're right, in some ways we are ahead in that respect, and we are acquiring influence and powers slightly in an area of vacuum, because beforehand national parliaments weren't really doing this. And the other thing which has happened, of course, there was the dissolution of the Western European Union Parliamentary Assembly, which had some role in the past over scrutinizing CSDP missions. That's coming to an end this year. And we haven't really come up with an alternative body which will marry national MPs and MEPs together in scrutiny and oversight. So in the meantime, the Foreign Affairs Committee and its subcommittee on defense and security has been, as it were, wading into that territory. So yes, inevitably all institutions will try and carve out influence for themselves if they can. when Cathy was appointed, she was very new to the job. It was quite a daunting challenge. It was in the middle of the Eurozone crisis and all sorts of other things and distractions going on. Inevitably, the Parliament, under people like Brok and Gualtieri, were able to carve out a significant influence for the Parliament. And I, as a British MEP, don't have a problem with that, because I think that scrutiny and oversight, provided it doesn't result in a single foreign policy whereby our national interests can be overridden or vetoed, I really have no problem at all. And most of the time, when I'm talking to diplomats at UKREP or ministers or whatever, it's about having a joined-up approach both at EU level and at national level. So I don't really see the conflict. It certainly hasn't happened so far that I felt that I'm undermining British national foreign policy by also scrutinising at EU level.
Thank you very much. Well, I throw the floor open. One over there, yeah.
Thank you. Chris Short, just a very quick question. When you were going through very rapidly some of the weaknesses of the EEAS, you said the Commission was able to hang on to too many of its staff. I just wonder if you could elaborate a bit on that and say, you know, what do you mean by that, and what would your idea be?
It's basically reports that have come back to me when I've questioned the lack of resources, that in some cases that the Commission has hung on, particularly in the areas which are slightly grey, like you know the European Neighbourhood Policy and things like that, where there are lots of country staff, you know, still attached to some of the commissions, which would probably be doing political kind of work, which would be better off if they were detached and doing the political work under the EAS umbrella. And I won't name names or countries, because that wouldn't be appropriate, but it's been reported to me by senior EAS functionaries that they feel that they're short-staffed because the Commission have held on to some resources at the time when the service was being set up.
Georgina Butler, Conservative Policy Forum. Do you think on the doorstep people actually understand what the EEAS stands for? And do you think it's part of your role to try and explain what it is, why it isn't a duplication of the British Foreign Service?
At the doorstep, to be honest, there are most members of the public understanding of the EU is all about, you know, waste and corruption and gravy train, and they don't really understand that anything to do with the EU common foreign security policy. And why should they? I mean, the foreign policy is never a particularly sexy subject at the doorstep, unless in London. It becomes an issue in London for me when I'm talking to some of the communities from some of the ethnic groupings where foreign policy issues are more important than transport, health or education. London is very different from anywhere else in the country. So in London, where you stand on Cyprus or the Middle East or India, Pakistan over Kashmir or Sri Lanka, for many of London's minority communities, that is the issue. And they will immediately ask you, where do you stand and what's the European Union doing about it? If I get foreign policy questions directed to me in my mailbag, it tends to be from people whose provenance and origins come from these countries one or two generations back. But for the rest of the population, no, they're not really interested in foreign policy generally, and they have no idea what the EU or, for that matter, the Foreign Office get up to in most of these issues. So I don't think it's a doorstep type of issue, frankly. It's a somewhat Guardian or Times type of issue that, you know, we could have lengthy debates about. Certainly the tabloids talked about the EU diplomatic service as if it was something completely new and de novo, you know, hundreds of missions being opened all over the world for the first time, as if the EU, you know, as if the EU Commission, the European Commission, hadn't had these delegations there for the last 50 years doing trade and aid and other things, you know. So it's slightly over-embellished, this EU diplomatic service. And, of course, there has been a demand for fresh funds for various things, and that's what we need to scrutinise very, very carefully.
Thank you. Hello, Catherine Colvin. I work at the House of Lords. Just on a point of information, the last point you mentioned about the successor to the WEU Assembly and the scrutiny role, there has just now been set up something called COFAD, which is the Committee on Foreign Affairs, Defence and Security, which takes over from the previous chairman of Foreign Affairs Committees and chairman of Defence Committees meetings. And that's a forum which brings together the chairman of the committees in the national parliaments and the European Parliament. It's the first meeting in that format took place in Cyprus in September, and the idea is that it will be held every 6 months under the president in the presidency capital. So that, I think, is the was the idea. And Baroness Ashton came and spoke, and I think she will always aim to come and speak, but whether you know her other schedule permits. But that I think, is the successor, or an attempt to make the successor of it. And the format of it is still evolving.
Yeah, no, there were big arguments with Julian Grenville and Brock and the number of MEPs and the number of national delegates. So I'm glad they've had their first meeting. But unfortunately, it was poorly attended, I gather, in Cyprus from the MEP's point of view. I heard that not many of my colleagues went. Yeah, which is disappointing. Well, Cyprus is quite a long way to go. That's the problem.
Ruben Cacciatore from the Canadian High Commission. You mentioned that the European Parliament was getting a bit more politicized. Foreign policy was being politicized with perhaps these new powers. Could you comment on the ACTA? Was it a one-off? Is that something we might see again?
Well, I mean, ACTA is an example. This, for those of you who don't know, is to do with counterfeit of documents, particularly you know, computer software. No, the European Parliament, I tell you, the big wake-up call was before ACTA. It was about 3 years ago, or 2009, when we had the vote on SWIFT, which was to do with the transfer of funds electronically within the banking system internationally. The Americans thought this could all be stitched up at national level by talking to national governments and national parliaments. And then they'd forgotten that under Lisbon, the European Parliament had a veto on this. And when a lady stood up from the Liberals and said, would the US Congress ever allow European authorities to sort of do a phishing exercise in American citizens' bank accounts and where they were sending their money, I knew that the game was up for the Americans. Now, not unsurprisingly, 2 weeks later, Joe Biden turned up and said nice things to the European Parliament, and a month later, I was invited to meet the U.S. ambassador, both the one to the Court of St. James and the one in Brussels, had a joint double act coming to Brussels to get to know their MEPs, because the U.S., having gone from having half a diplomat, suddenly set up a whole department within the State Department trying to understand what the European Parliament was all about when they lost the vote on SWIFT, which then went through about 6 months later. So there have been a series of issues now where the Parliament is flexing its muscles and demonstrating its legislative powers. At the moment, we have huge, I didn't really go into that, but a huge debate going on about the free trade agreements, which obviously have a significant impact on foreign policy. There's one going on with Peru and Colombia, where the Labour MEPs have been fighting tooth and nail and the socialists to block it, whereas the right and the Liberals want it. And that will hopefully go through fairly shortly, particularly after the Americans gave the and the Canadians gave the green light to it. So foreign policy and trade policy and our new acquired powers in trade will also give us an enhanced role in dealing with third country governments. But ACTA was just the start of it. You know, there have been a number of these things which the Parliament starts to veto, and therefore the Parliament, as a consequence, we will find the Commission, whilst they are shaping these agreements, including there's one going through with Canada now, a trade agreement over the whole issue of the oil sands, and trying to stop it because of that, the Greens are trying to stop it because of the environmental consequences. Increasingly, the Commission's engaging. Sorry? No. I mean, well, I'm being lobbied by the not me particularly, but I mean, we do an opinion of the Foreign Affairs Committee. But the point is that because it's being resisted by the Greens and so on, the Canadians are lobbying us, and the Commission are trying to judge what tweaking of the agreement has to be made in order to get it through the Parliament. So, yes, the Parliament has acquired significant new powers, because there isn't the whipping that goes on in the House of Commons. You know, the government normally, obviously they lost the vote the other day on the budget, but normally the government can say, I can deliver the Conservative vote in the House of Commons, and that will become a law. But in the European Parliament, it's much more difficult.
Could I ask a question, not so much for your views, but rather your view of the general view of the European Parliament on the future progression of the EEAS and the CFSP. I mean, I think I can probably guess at your views because I saw your reaction to the Vestavella report, which was basically critical of it in much the same way as almost anybody in this country is probably critical of it. At the same time, with people like Elmar Brok in key positions in the European Parliament, who's very integrationist, and there are lots of others in the European Parliament who are integrationist, who will want to communitize the CFSP, probably. How do you judge those pressures? How much of a problem do you think they'd be for you? Where do you think they're going?
Well, I mean, you know, where's the European Union going? Will this country be a member of it in 10 years' time? I'm not very good at crystal ball gazing and giving you definitive answers because, you know, with the Eurozone crisis, with so many other forces pulling different directions, it's very hard to say. But you know, certainly as a Conservative MEP who's a Euro realist rather than either a secessionist or an integrationist, I will engage pragmatically with whatever's there and try and make it work. I mean, I'm doing a report right now on the Horn of Africa, for instance, in which, you know, UNAVFOR Atalanta, which is a Royal Navy-led mission, fighting piracy in the Indian Ocean. Generally, I think it's doing a good job, and I think it would be churlish to say anything else, and I encourage its success. There's now talk of, missions going off to the Sahel, to Mali with ECOWAS and stuff. So, I think there are times when the EU flag may be useful in CSDP missions where NATO can't really deliver because an American-led initiative, wouldn't bring on board, say, in the Indian Ocean, the non-aligned movement countries like India, for instance. So I'm pretty pragmatic. I'm not very dogmatic. But where it's going, I just don't know, because I think until European Union sorts out the Eurozone crisis and we also resolve the new treaty, which is going to be proposed in the next couple of years, and banking union, fiscal union, political union, what it means for this country, the CFSP, I'm afraid, will, take second, second place to the main thing, which is the economy.
One of the things that we've talked quite a bit about is something which isn't about dogmatism and about pragmatism, but it could, but both could affect the outcome, and that is just how much we should share. So one of the things we talked about is one of our people here is from the EU delegation in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and he said there they've got a Schengen house. And they deliver the visas and they do all the consular work, or not all of it, but a lot of it. And I wonder where someone like you would stand in terms of whether you'd support on pragmatic grounds, it would save the Treasury all sorts of money, or would you then say, no, you can't have British visas delivered by a foreign body or something like that? I mean, does pragmatism outweigh the ideology, or is it the other way around on an issue like that?
Well, I know that the view of HMG, Her Majesty's Government, is that we are opposed to a consular function as far as British citizens are concerned. Although I have to say it's slightly incompatible with the fact that in some parts of the world where I've come across the consular officer, they're actually locally employed. They're actually not a British citizen themselves. So I promise you, including Bratislava, by the way, they have a local Slovak citizen who's the consular officer. So, it is slightly curious that, but of course it's better to have somebody who's a compatriot who understands the culture of your country if they are the consul, because so many of the issues they deal with need that kind of, interaction. But I can understand, again, on pragmatic grounds, if you're a small country like Estonia, you could probably station one diplomat in a middle-ranking country somewhere within a EU delegation, and that would be far more cost-effective than, you can't have an embassy at all, or even having an embassy in some neighbouring country or quite a long way away. So I can understand, as budgets become very tight, all these things need to be looked at. And I think the European External Action Service has to prove, and I've had this conversation with, the Chief Operating Officer and others, that they need to prove that the national foreign ministry budgets are being saved money as a result of value added from having this, enhanced EU delegations with a consular department or whatever. So far, as far as I can see, there haven't been any significant cuts beyond those demanded by national austerity. And so, they do need to have an audit trail to prove that. If the External Action Service can show genuine cost savings to national bilateral budgets, including the British Foreign Office, then I think people like myself would warm to it much more on pragmatic grounds.
Yeah. Could you wait for the microphone?
We know each other, Rosa.
Just following on what you were saying, how can the External Action Service make cuts when it's actually doing a little bit more than it was, with a few more costs than it had, because the national diplomats working there are paid for by the External Action Service now and not by their foreign affairs ministries. So in this context, how can the External Action... It's doing a lot more. I mean, just coordinating the Foreign Affairs Council is actually quite a lot more work. This was work which was previously carried out by the... rotating presidency, and every 6 months the permanent representation of one of the country that held the rotating presidency would be doubled in terms of size in order to carry out the workload. And these people would start working on the dossiers a year before taking on the rotating presidency. So we actually have a situation in which the External Action Service is doing a bit more than previously, with zero additional resources and a few extra costs. So how can it actually make further costs in order to demonstrate to member states its cost benefit, shall we say?
Well, I mean, to be honest, my line is budget neutrality. I haven't actually asked for a cut in absolute terms. I've asked for budget neutrality rather than the 5.6? I can't remember the figure now. They wanted a 5-6% rise, which was way above inflation. So I'm sticking to the line that David Cameron has on the MFF. But I am absolutely sure that cuts can be made. I have been to many delegations in certain parts of the world of the EU, and the diplomats get paid an awful lot more than they would do if they were national diplomats stationed abroad, like orders of magnitude, five times sometimes, you know, from the Eastern European countries. They get paid a huge amount of money compared to what they would get. So the salaries probably are very, very generous. They travel business class, even for short hauls sometimes, whereas British diplomats now, under 4 or 5 hours, have to go economy. You know, even the junior ministers go economy now on less than 4 hours. So there are lots of cuts that could be made, I can assure you. And it's a question of somebody going in there and doing a forensic analysis. But I haven't actually called for a cut. I've just called for budget neutrality, which is the view of the Conservative delegation.
On that point, in your last one, you talked in your first remarks about your budgetary nuclear option. When you are talking to David O'Sullivan and others, are you merely advising and warning and exhorting, or can the Parliament make more specific its oversight role, controlling, encouraging with a bit more teeth the Commission, for example, not so much to overstaff or to misallocate roles at the expense of the AS?
Well, I think I come from a particular political group which is specifically demanding value added and value for money. It doesn't apply to other political groups in the same way. So what I may think doesn't necessarily reflect the view of the entire Parliament. So you're saying, would I be demanding this? I might demand it, but, you know, unless the other groups demanded it as well, not likely to fly, is it? So my views are my views and reflect the views of the European Conservative and Reformist group, which is the fifth group of the Parliament. The EPP, is quite happy to spend more and for Europe to do more. And so that's not the view of the Parliament. My austerity measures don't necessarily translate to the view of the Parliament. But the trouble is that, you know, in many countries in Europe, the citizenry are aware of the largesse and the expenditure issue. And so this could result at the next European election in a backlash against some of the more mainstream parties.
It's Jozef Batra, Comenius University in Bratislava. We had earlier on a debate about British interests, and I mentioned a speech by William Hague, who said that the UK will never outsource the promotion of British interests to anyone, including the External Action Service. But in your speech, you made an interesting point that this is actually reconcilable. So whatever comes out of the Council in the decision making as a joint action is actually perfectly in line with British interests. So I wonder, is that the point you're making? Is the EAS a carrier, a potential carrier of British interests, of the promotion of British interests?
Well, as I said before, I'm not going to name names, but I've had it from extremely senior people in the government and the Foreign Office that, on balance, the EAS is, safeguarding and promoting British foreign policy objectives. So it's perfectly true that, you know, the Foreign Office under William Hague is also opening new embassies in different parts of the world, from, you know, Taiwan to, I think in El Salvador and a few others. We've opened embassies and we're expanding and we're cutting in other parts. When I say we, the British Foreign Office and the British government. So there is a bilateral diplomacy in trade and foreign policy, but on the big issues, generally, you know, you can't put more than cigarette paper between the views of most of the major European countries on on most of the issues. You know, occasionally we differ, like Iraq or whatever, but most of the time I think we all sing from the same hymn sheet. When I speak to UKREP, they're all waiting to see what the outcome of the General Affairs Council will be and what the new common position will be before actually giving me their views. So, so there is a slight inconsistency there. I think it is sort of, you know, I used to be a psychiatrist. I won't use the word schizophrenic sometimes, but there is a sort of duality of bilateral mode thinking and then also EU multilateral and then possibly even UN. You know, people have different personas in different bodies, I suppose.
Usurping my role as chairman, I'd also like to offer a comment on that, which is essentially that the High Representative has to work, preferably with all the member states, but absolutely has to work with the large member states. A High Representative who gets out ahead of Germany, Britain, France, I can name others, but let's just stop at those three, is dead in the water, absolutely dead in the water. Now, Cathy Ashton has been careful not to do that. Javier Solana, who was the guy I worked with, was extremely careful not to do that. He knew exactly how far he could go. Sometimes, there's a quote from him in the Financial Times in about 2004, and I don't have it in my head, but he was asked whether he always felt he had to go back to the member states, and he said, I know what the member states think. If I consulted them all the time, I'd never get anything done, so I can do what I like. Well, I don't think Cathy Ashton has quite reached that point of self-confidence and experience and confidence in the member states. But basically, that's what you need in a leader as a high representative, is somebody who knows where the member states are and knows the threshold beyond which he or she cannot step without, in effect, committing political suicide. I think that's why you'll find that the CFSP and the CSDP are always aligned. No, they're not always aligned, but don't transgress any major British, but likewise no German or French or other major member state interest, and probably minor member state interest. Minor, I mean small member state interest too, because when push comes to shove, there is always a veto. But people are persuadable not to veto if everybody else is lined up.
Yeah.
Question I was very impressed by your review. I think it was very encouraging what you were saying in general. About the big three, there is an interesting report out from Stefan Lehne at Carnegie in Brussels, saying basically that the big three are determining policy in Brussels. And then there is a question about whether we should have an exercise towards a review of the European Union security strategy. And what people say is then, no, the big three don't want that because that would lead to a situation whereby you would go into this very broad discussion among all the member states and you would be blocked and nothing would come out and it would be a mess. And rather, the three big will make the strategy for themselves. Is the European Parliament discussing this issue? I know that AFET has come out with a recommendation for a strong foreign policy contribution. Do you share that view?
Well, the AFET and things like the Brok Report and what have you on the annual review of the Common Foreign Policy, they want almost a sort of qualified majority voting approach, you know, to do away with the national veto. And of course, the national veto is a real veto for the big countries which have a global or historically global presence. And I suspect, no disrespect to Maltese and Cyprus, that you know they wouldn't really normally want to exercise a veto over our policies in the Congo or what's happening in Latin America or whatever. So it does tend to be, in my experience, the big three or four others. That there are rising stars like Poland and Spain or Latin. It tends to be actually often that the countries lead in the areas where they have their historical legacies. So, you know, Portugal and Spain, you'd have to carry them if it's something to do with Latin America. If it's something to do with, former British imperial country of any or Commonwealth country, then the British would be very key to the policy and likewise for France. So it does, the world is sort of divided into sort of spheres of influence for each or one or more member states because of their connections in trade and history. And that tends to lead the council, in my experience, on these issues. Occasionally there are grey areas like the Western Balkans, and I'm the rapporteur for Montenegro, where, you know, for instance, Sweden was blocking Montenegro's right to, as it were, open negotiations until the very last minute for some peculiar reason, you know, which I won't go into. But, you know, so there are exceptions, and you have to carry 27 countries. And on paper, it looks impossible. But in practice, obviously, the major European countries, which have a long history and tradition of foreign policy, tend to take a lead. And that's going to be the case for the foreseeable future. Do I want more done at EU level? No. I think we have the balance has to be, it's a very delicate issue where the balance is. But where there is a CFSP, I think that, you know, if you get, as I said, 500 million people, 27 votes in the UN, including two permanent members of the Security Council, veto-wielding members, it's a major force to be reckoned with and will be so for many years to come. But it is a fluid situation. And at the moment, as I said to Brian earlier, and until the EU can stabilize its own future in terms of the Eurozone and the economy and all that, we don't really know what the CFSP will look like in the next decade or so. And also, we don't really know what's happening, you know, in other parts of the world. You know, the assertiveness of China, Japan, and there's certain sort of dynamics which are happening, which, you know, would we have a role in, would we not? I mean, even over Gaza, there were complaints this week that the EU wasn't really very present. You know, the Americans were in there immediately and so on. And where was the EU's role in what happened in Israel, Gaza? So it's variable.
Well, I think that those sounded very much like concluding remarks, if they weren't intended to be.
Not particularly. But
it is the time for our conclusion, yeah. 5 o'clock, and I thought that was a very apposite conclusion. It just remains for me to thank you, Charles, for a refreshing view, not necessarily expected from a Conservative, even member of the European Parliament, but refreshing and realistic, and believing in an active European foreign policy, so long as it represents the views of the member states, which is, of course, what it is designed to do. So I hope you were all as encouraged as I was, and I ask you to join me in thanking our speaker.